specialized in subtle acts of rebellion. There were 34 candy bars under her bed, after all. But still, I wonder who was behind the camera. I wonder for whom the obscenity was meant. Mother watches me from the hall as I sift through the photographs, fanning them out across my bed. I ignore her. I expect her to move on after she reassures herself that I am doing nothing much of interest, but instead she steps forward and into the room. She twists one of the carved wooden finials at the foot of my bed frame and clears her throat. "What have you got there?" she asks. I hand her the picture of Lissa and me at the house in St. John. I was wearing a hat that Lissa had woven out of reeds. It was lopsided and scratchy, and the inside rubbed against my forehead, but those things didn't matter. I wore that hat everywhere for the whole rest of that summer, and I cried for a day and a half when the wind blew it so far out into the ocean that it was beyond rescuing. I thought that Lissa might blame me, might love me less for not being careful, but Lissa seemed to have forgotten that she'd made the hat in the first place and kept asking why I was so upset. It was Naomi who leaped into the water as I stood crying on the beach and tried to save it. But by the time she got beyond the waves, the tug of the currents had already carried the hat away. "My goodness, you both look so young," Mother says, and I see her mouth relax into a smile that might almost be natural. "We were young. We'd have to be. She's been gone for so long." Mother looks genuinely wounded, and for the first time in a long while, I remember that this woman is my mother and more than just name, that there might have once been a part of her that actually cared. "Yes, well, your sister always did have a flair for the dramatic. Did you know I often wondered if she broke her leg on purpose? I don't know why. It just struck me as something she would do, for the attention." I am angry, though I cannot tell whether it is because the statement is ungenerous or because I have to admit that it is true. Whatever her failings as a parent, my mother knew Lissa well. "It runs in the family, I guess." Mother ignores this. Possibly she did not hear me. She has chosen a photograph from Christmas at the lake house and is running a nail along the border.
"It's all of us together," she says.
I look. She is right. Someone else must have taken it. A cook or a nanny or else one of the crew. I watch Mother for a moment, intrigued by the emotions playing out across her face. Does she think there are cameras here in the room with us, or is she genuinely remorseful about whatever it was that made Lissa go? "Do you ever miss her?" I ask finally.
"Don't ask ridiculous questions."
"It's not ridiculous. You never talk about her. What am I supposed to think?"
"It takes commitment, what we do. Elizabeth wasn't strong enough. She wasn't devoted to the cause. We're better off without her."
"You mean the show was better off?"
"I mean we, as a family, are better off letting her follow her own path. And I don't blame her for it. In fact, I'm happy that she's found direction, that she's found peace."
"How could you possibly know anything about her if you haven't spoken with her in 3.5 years?
"I know that if something were really wrong, she would have called. I'm her mother, after all."
"Mom?" I say, and she looks startled. I have never called her that before. "Why did she leave? What happened?" Instead of answering, Mother stands and straightens her skirt.
"Lights out in 5 minutes. We have a big day tomorrow."
I wait, but from her look it is clear that I should not expect an answer. I start to brush a hand across my bedspread to gather up the pictures and put them back into their bin. Mother straightens one of the ceramic horses I keep on a shelf over my desk.
"I miss her every day," she tells me from the hall.
I look up to ask Mother again why Lissa left, but she is already gone.
I can't focus during the interview.
I don't remember any of the questions, and I stumble over the answers we've agreed upon. Rourke holds the narrative together with some help from Libby, and they play the whole thing off as wedding nerves. I try to relax and answer questions about flower arrangements and rolled fondant. People want to know the color of the bridesmaids' dresses and whether any of my nieces and nephews will be included in the service. I tell a story about 3-year-old Millicent, who was being fitted for a flower girl dress and ran out of the boutique wearing nothing but a pair of Mary Janes and streaked across a busy parking lot. Naomi tripped as she tried to chase her daughter and was nearly hit by a car. The memory of the mortification on my mother's face is enough to distract me for the rest of the taping, and I somehow plow through to the end. I expect Libby to lay into me for making a mess of the interview, but instead she sets aside her note cards and says, "Wait here, I'll go see if she's arrived." My palms have been sweating since we started the session, and I wipe them down the sides of my dress, aware that the curls in my hair are beginning to fall and stick to the back of my neck. "If I sweat any more, I think I'll dissolve into a puddle like the Wicked Witch," I tell Rourke. He puts his arm loosely around me.
"It's the lights. They were hotter than usual."
I laugh. "You're a terrible liar. We both know that isn't true."
"I think that what we both know is that I'm not a terrible liar. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten this far."
"Fair enough."
"You'll be fine," he tries to reassure me. "And with any luck, you'll find out what you need to know."
I swallow hard and try to breathe out slowly. My morning sickness has mostly gone away since we got back from Cuba, but now I feel a surge of nausea. Rourke's look of concern goes out of focus, and I blink rapidly as I will myself to remain upright. Fainting would be too cliche. We are interrupted by a loud crack as a metal door swings open, and Libby walks back into the studio.
"She's in my dressing room."
I stand motionless, frozen in time, until Rourke asks,
"Do you want me to go with you?"
And I come back to myself enough to shake my head and follow Libby into the hall. It is the same corridor we walked through just before the interview, but it seems brighter now and longer. The walls and ceiling bleed together, and I feel as if I am walking through a tunnel that goes on without any end. I do not see the door to Libby's dressing room until I am standing right in front of it. And even then, I am confused for a moment until I reach out a hand to touch the wall, and the cool granularity of paint rolled over plaster brings things into focus.
"Ready?" Libby asks.
Her pupils widen, and I know that she has found my sister for me in no small part because her own sister has been taken to a place where she cannot be found. "Ready," I echo, hoping that by saying it out loud, I can make it true. Libby turns the knob to open the door and then backs out of the way to let me enter. And because at this point there is no way around it, I walk forward, even though I am not at all certain that I have the strength to face the person inside. I hear Libby shut the door behind me as Lissa stands. She looks unsure of herself, which surprises me for some reason. "Leap before you look" had been one of her mottos. I did not think she was capable of being nervous. She takes a step forward as if to hug me, then stops. Her hair is darker than I remember, longer. Unkempt is what Mother would call it. But Lissa looks beautiful and a little wild. She looks like the person she was always meant to be. I have played this moment out countless times over the years. But in my mind, Lissa was always the one to speak first. She is supposed to say something irreverent or else offer an apology. She is supposed to tousle my hair the way she used to or make a joke about how much I've grown. But instead, she just stands there, and all of the things I have imagined saying in return slip away, and I am left with nothing. I open my mouth, and what I produce is something between a giggle
and a sob, and all of a sudden I am blubbering so much that for a second it seems as if I can't breathe. Eventually I manage to get out. How could you leave me all alone? And now her arms do wrap around me, and I feel her rib cage shaking. And I know that she is crying too. It is a long time before we are able to say anything. And when we do talk, it is not at all how I expected. She wants to know how the remodel turned out in the upstairs bathroom, and whether you can take a shower now without freezing or getting burned. She asks what happened to Mrs. Peachum's labradoodle, Roscoe, whom Lissa used to take for walks, and who liked to pee in the spot where our own dog, Blister, had been buried, as if making some sort of offering to the dead. It is the little things she seems most interested in, and then I realize that it is the little things that she has not been able to find out about on TV. After a long while, I ask, "Why did you go?" We are sitting on a narrow couch. Lissa's feet are tucked up beneath her, and I am lying with my legs up over the armrest so that my head is on my sister's knee. She smooths my hair back from my face.
"It's complicated,"
she tells me. "Isn't it always?" Lissa leans her head back and looks up at a watermark on the ceiling.
"You know how it is there? I was suffocating."
"So it wasn't anything more than that?" I feel Lissa's muscles tense, but even so, I know that if she tells me it was just the cameras she was trying to escape from, I'll believe her. That's how much I want it to be true. Instead of saying no, she asks me,
"Why?"
And because this is the entire reason I asked her here to see me, I say, "I'm pregnant." There is a moment when it is as if the air has gone out of the room, because neither of us is breathing. But then it passes, and Lissa says,
"I was afraid of that."
I sit up and face her, my eyes flashing. Saying it out loud to Lissa, I realize for the first time that I have decided to have this baby. Not by default. Not just because Rourke found me and I didn't take the pills. I have decided that I want it no matter how he or she came to be. "Aren't you going to ask me who the father is?" Lissa shakes her head and bites down hard on her lower lip. I can see the blood.
"I don't have to,"
she whispers finally.
"I already know."
Candy calls not long after that to make sure we are on schedule for the campaign event. Mother had eventually conceded to announcing Caleb's run at the bandstand in the town park rather than on the church lawn at the insistence of his campaign manager, a classmate from Yale named Ellery Lester, who has become a sudden fixture and is now always at Caleb's side. He went on about how the polling shows that Caleb has his work cut out for him with the secular voters in the district, while, naturally, he's got the evangelicals in the bag. This is why it is so important that the announcement be made in neutral territory. As a result, Rourke and I have to be ready before we leave the studio, since there is nowhere to change once we get to the park. I slip out of my dress and into a peacock blue skirt and gold blouse. Rourke carries our bags out to his car while I hug Lissa goodbye.
"I'm glad that you told me,"
she says,
"and I'm relieved that at least from here on out you'll be safe. I know Rourke will make sure of that. You're lucky to have found him."
"I know."
"It's good that you won't have to do this on your own."
"Like you did?"
"Well, I made a clean break of it. It will be different for you. You'll have a baby. It will be ratings gold. Mother won't just let you go."
"The way she let you?"
Lissa smirks. "I didn't give her any choice."
"You mean you blackmailed her?"
"Maybe just a little. It was hard, though. Final. There was no going back. It will be easier the way you're doing it."
"Which way is that?"
Lissa shrugs. "The way that doesn't start a war."
Her expression almost makes me believe that she knows about the library and what I've hidden there. Suddenly, I want to tell her everything.
I want to tell Rourke as well, but something stops me. I get into the car, but as Rourke starts the engine, I roll down the window and lean out.
Wouldn't you say that a war has already been started?
Lissa smiles sadly, but does not answer. She raises a hand, and then we pull away. At first, Rourke drives without saying anything, but after a few minutes, he looks at me out of the corner of his eye to say,
I guess that means you found out what you needed to know. Now, what are you going to do about it?
I know our cameras are at the campaign event, but they are lost in a sea of reporters. There is a split second when I think I catch sight of the familiar face of one of the show's own cameramen, but then he is swallowed again by the roiling crowd. All the major networks are there, and I recognize a few of the local bloggers. Ellery Lester has delivered what he promised. Mother, on the other hand, has produced a good number of Daddy's congregation. If things go according to plan, Caleb may very well have an audience even larger than anything Mother and Daddy have ever been able to wrangle on their own. Rourke and I wait on the bandstand with the rest of the family for Caleb's car to arrive. Ellery finishes handing out American flags and then, making note of the approaching Land Rover, signals that it is time to raise these flags and cheer. The car stops and Caleb climbs out of the front passenger side door, waves, and turns to help Naomi and the kids out of the back. Naomi and Millicent are in dresses cut from matching blue fabric, while little Nate wears a white shirt and a red bow tie. Caleb carries him with one arm and waves with the other, and together they walk toward the stage. Once there, Caleb hands Nathan to Maddie and kisses Naomi on the cheek before taking the podium. I try to tune out Caleb's speech, but it is punctuated by buzzwords like America and freedom and religious liberty. Every time he says one of these, the crowd cheers and I jump a little, startled by their fervor, by the frenzy with which they whip their little flags in the air above their heads. The breeze picks up, and though it is gentle, it is still enough to make the red, white, and blue balloon arch beneath which Caleb is standing begin to sway to and fro. The crowd subconsciously mimics the movement, and soon they are undulating with a force as primal as the tide. Caleb gestures to Naomi, says something about soulmates, and Rourke reaches out and takes my hand and squeezes it, as if to say that this will all be over soon. And it is. Caleb announces his run for the House of Representatives, and Bennett Tull himself takes the stage. I look around and try to see where he could have been hiding. He shakes hands with Caleb, as if to pass the torch, and smiles and waves at his constituents, his hand raised like that of a conductor calling for a crescendo, and he is immediately rewarded as the chorus of shouts begins to swell. All at once, it is finished, and we are being swept away. Ellery Lester had been clear on the matter of not allowing interviews. He wants all of the airtime to be filled up by this scene alone and its meticulously crafted optics. If the networks want to supplement with other shots, they will have to use footage from Six for Hicks, preferably episodes when Caleb was younger. Ellery says that voters are naturally drawn to those candidates they know best. And what better way to drive home how well all of America knows Caleb than to highlight what are essentially home videos of him growing up before their very eyes. Caleb shakes the hands that are thrust at him across the temporary barricade. Naomi stands a little to the side with Nathan on her hip, while Millicent hangs onto her skirt. Naomi's teeth look bright against her dark red lipstick, and I wonder if she had them whitened especially for the occasion, and whether she told the dentist to bill the campaign. The strobe of the cameras flash like bursts of summer lightning, and Millie begins to wail. Naomi, unable to put Nathan down, pats Millie's head in a way I'm sure is meant to be soothing, but the girl only cries harder. Naomi looks toward Caleb for help, but his back is turned. Heedless of either his wife or his daughter, Caleb moves farther away, reaching his hand into the fray, pumping his arm furiously up and down. He shakes the hand of a girl not much older than I am, and she looks up at him eagerly. Keeping a hold of her hand, Caleb leans forward, so that his lips practically brush her hair as he whispers something to her. The girl blushes. Naomi takes a step toward him then, opens her mouth as if to call his name, but Rourke is already there, lifting up Millicent and rescuing her, spinning her around so that his body blocks the flashing of the lights, asking her about the ribbons in her hair. Naomi smiles at me in a conspiratorial way, a look I find difficult to interpret. But perhaps she only means it to be kind. Finally, Ellery signals to Caleb that it is time to leave. Caleb gives the crowd one last wave, and we all turn to walk away. Then, apparently unaware of Ellery Lester's instructions regarding interviews, the press surges forward to follow us toward the parked cars. Bulky microphones crowd my peripheral vision, while reporters call out my brother's name. Rourke charges ahead of them and deposits Millicent safely in her car seat, and closes the door to block her from the noise. Naomi gives his hand a grateful squeeze, and circles around to the other side of the car and begins the task of buckling Nathan in as well. I feel a hand on my arm, and I stop and turn. "We have no comments at this time, thank you," Mother says brusquely, but it is only Libby, and so I grab hold of Mother's hand and pull her to a stop as well, cutting my palm on one of her enormous rings. "Mother," I say to placate her, "this is Liberty Bell. I'm sure you recognize her from our chats together. I think a formal introduction is long overdue." Mother collects herself quickly and switches on her smile. "Of course! Liberty, my dear, thank you for all you've done for our darling Esther Ann. We couldn't be more pleased with your coverage. You've really given the public a chance to get to know these two young people and the lovely man and woman they are growing up to be."
"The pleasure has been all mine, Mrs. Hicks, I assure you."
Libby is jostled slightly to one side, and Mother pulls my hand to lead me toward the cars. I free it and impulsively reach forward and take Libby's pad of paper out from beneath her fingers. There is a pen nestled in the spiral binding, and I extract it and open the pad to a blank page near the back. I should have done this when we were alone. Maybe I should have done this the first time we met, but for some reason I was not sure I was brave enough until right now. Something about being up in front of all those people, about the way they clapped and cheered with so much hope, and the way that girl looked at my brother, has finally made this necessary. "You were asking about the old church at the edge of town, the one with the big stone cross out front? I felt so foolish, but when you asked who had founded the parish, my mind went completely blank. I was nervous about the interview, I guess." Libby tilts her head to one side and her eyebrows come together. Alyssa used to look at me like that when I asked her questions she thought I should know the answer to, like where to find Germany on a map or what French kissing meant. "Essie, I have no idea," Libby begins, but I cut her off. I need her to understand. If I wait until I am home and can text her again, then she will have already left town. And in any case, I am nearly certain that I will lose my nerve. It's happened before. So I continue. "That's really no excuse, though, since Daddy talks about him all the time. He's something of a hero to our family. Before he raised that church's steeple, these parts were entirely populated by heathens, native and European alike. It's completely inexcusable for me to forget his name." "You must be talking about Livingston James," Mother says. "Esther Ann, we've surely taught you better than that." I giggle and shake my head from side to side and write down the name. "Reverend James, of course, how silly of me. My nerves must really be on edge. Mother, don't you think Libby would find the story of the congregation's early years inspiring? Perhaps Daddy has some old diaries or books that she could borrow." Mother's smile stiffens and she squeezes my hand so tightly that I wince. However pleased she might be with the Liberty Bell who exists on camera to promote her daughter's sham engagement, she does not want her in our house. Mother glances down at her watch and says, "The library's open for a few more hours. They have an entire section of historic documents that deal with the founding of the town. You should stop in and browse through them before you begin your journey home."
It all sounds very interesting,
Libby says, her words coming out slowly. Oh, it's fascinating. I agree. Mother is right. You should absolutely stop into the library before you get on your way. There are so many wonderful stories from that time, stories that give us a better idea of who we are today. But none of them compare, I think, with really looking into the Reverend James's eyes. They speak volumes, Daddy always says. They open up a doorway to the past. I am not sure whether I have said too much or not enough, but it's hard to think with Mother watching. Now her tug on my hand becomes more insistent, and I can only hope Libby has understood as I am guided to our family's car. Daddy's secretary, Liam, is beside him at the wheel, so Mother climbs in back with me. The last thing that I see is Libby's look of confusion. Then Liam pulls the car away.
Liberty. The press mills about for another 5 minutes, and then the crowd thins and I'm left standing in the park almost entirely on my own. I see Margot signaling frantically for my attention from the doorway of the coffee shop where she was hiding during Caleb Hicks's campaign event. I look down toward the corner where Essie's SUV disappeared and give my head a shake as if to clear the fog that has settled over my brain. Mama used to send me out to the barn anytime my brain got full up like that. Go get a wiggle on, Mama would say, and don't come back until you've simmered down. Being around the horses could usually be depended on to settle my thoughts. I shake my head again. It doesn't help. Reluctantly, I cross the street and join Margot at a window table at Common Grounds. I order an espresso, but I know the caffeine won't help me unravel what it was that Essie was trying to say. What's wrong? Margot asks. I screw up my face, uncertain how to answer. I don't know, I finally admit. Essie introduced me to her mother and then started talking about a Reverend James who lived here back when the town was first founded. Livingston James? How did you know that? Because the library is named after him. We drove by it. You can actually see it if you lean this way. Margot gestures out the window. It can't be, I tell Margot. What can't be? The library can't be named after Livingston James. If it were, then Essie never would have forgotten his name. Maybe she's not the library type, Margot begins. I raise my eyebrows, and then she says, All right, I take it back. She should have known his name. What of it? It didn't make sense for her to bring him up at all. She said I had asked her about his old church, but I never did. And then, after Mrs. Hicks reminded Essie of his name, she told me to go to the library to read about the congregation. Who did? Well, Mrs. Hicks first, but then Essie seconded it. She said something about how the past informs who it is that we become, which seemed fairly cliche even for her. Well, maybe there's something there that she wants you to see. If so, she couldn't really come right out and say so, not with her mother standing there. I take another sip of my coffee and feel my teeth begin to buzz. One of the baristas drops a glass and there is a round of applause. She takes an embarrassed bow and begins to sweep up the shards. There is more good-natured laughing, and all at once the caffeine kicks in and the faces of the strangers all around me seem to be melting. I blink and force myself to focus. We should go, I say, and I scrape my chair across the floor and bump the table as I stand. We should go, Margot repeats. Where exactly are we going? The bell above the door jingles as I push our way outside and point. To the Livingston James Library, of course. When we enter the library, a stern-looking woman holding court from behind the circulation desk purses her lips with obvious displeasure as we approach. Amazingly, she holds this expression without moving even a single muscle, while I explain that we would like to learn more about the library's namesake, Livingston James. At this, she sighs, as if it is all too much for her. And I get the sense that she is less offended by having to walk us to the back reading room than she is by the notion that there are still people in this world for whom Livingston James is not a household name. We walk at a snail's pace to the foot of a spiral staircase, and she wags her finger to indicate that we should climb. She does not follow. We are halfway up before she calls after us. There are some lovely portraits as well as the usual manuscripts, but the bust is my favorite. It was donated to the library by my great-great-grandfather nearly 150 years ago. There are a few snake hisses from the reading room, but these cease as soon as the patrons realize who it is they're shushing. I look up in time to see Margot disappear onto the second floor, and I begin to climb up after her. The room the stairs lead to is circular. We are in the squat tower at the far end of the building that is the only part of the library that rises above ground level. Dark wood beams cross the empty space above our heads, fanning out of the center of the tower like the spokes of a wheel. From the center of the wheel hangs an electric chandelier. Just beneath this, there is a large glass case of maps that look to have been hand-drawn onto yellowed parchment, with blue ink for rivers, black for roads, and green for the pastures and the wild tangle of forest that encircled the settlement to the north, south, east, and west. Margot taps a fingernail against the flat surface of the glass. It wasn't much, just the church and a handful of farms and houses. That's all there is in the town where I grew up, even now. It's the same with everything, I say. It starts out small and either grows or dies out. What do you think we're supposed to learn from this? I still don't know. I move over to the shelves, first pulling volumes out at random and leafing through them, then running my fingers along the bookcases themselves. Though what I'm looking for, I can't say. I find a family Bible, the once blank leaves at the very front and back, filled with names and dates of births and deaths and baptisms. I open the book to the center, half expecting to find the pages hollowed out in an homage to the Shawshank Redemption, with some message from Essie hidden inside. But there's only Ezekiel, the part about milk and honey. The pages so thin they are nearly translucent. Behind me, I can hear Margot open a book so old its spine practically creaks in protest. She sets it on a table and turns its pages. This one is written by Rosalind James, the Reverend's wife. It looks like a diary of the first 5 years of the church. I cross the room to join her at the table and say, those would qualify as the early years, I guess. Essie mentioned something about that. Margot leafs through the leather-bound volume and then plants a finger to pin the curling pages down. Here, she says. We both read Rosalind's description of the first Christmas pageant, the children dressed in real lamb's wool, the angel with her crown of straw. The congregation shared a simple supper in the rectory after the service, and Rosalind was particularly proud of how her pudding had turned out. There's nothing here, I say, after staring at the pages so long my eyes begin to tear. She can't possibly expect us to read everything from the first few years after the church was founded, can she? I don't know, Margot answers. What else did she say? I try to remember, but for a moment all I can recall is Celia Hicks's smile, the way her makeup made it look as if her face might crack. Nothing. The entire exchange couldn't have lasted more than a minute. At first, Essie asked her mother if Pastor Hicks might have some books that I could borrow to learn about the founding of the town, that sort of thing. Then Celia Hicks said I should just go to the library. I think she didn't want to be bothered, and I thought Essie might be disappointed, but she agreed so readily that I should visit the library that I figured it must have been what she wanted all along. She just didn't want to be the one to say it. And then? And then they left. They walked away. Really, that was the entire exchange. So maybe she actually just wanted you to learn some history. Maybe it's no more complicated than that. Judging by the dust, no one else has been up here in ages, even with the impressive bust the librarian's family paid for. Maybe Essie thought someone should give these books another chance. What did you say? Margot shrugs. Maybe she felt bad that these books had been forgotten. She's an odd kid, you have to admit that. No. The other thing. The bust. Essie said something about looking into Reverend James's eyes. The bust stands on a pedestal between two shelves. I hurry over to peer at it. Livingston James was a plump man, with very little hair on his head, a deficit he seemed to have thought he could make up for with the tangle of whiskers on either side of his face. Mama would have said he had been hit with the ugly stick, but she wouldn't have said this when she knew I was listening. His milky eyes look hollow. The piece is altogether a little frightening. He's hideous. Margot's voice comes from just behind my shoulder, and I jump. He was a man of the people. Which people? He looks more like a monster you would warn children about in a fairy tale. I lay a hand against the cool marble, then run my fingers over and under the rim of the pedestal and all the way down to the floor. There's nothing there. I stand and brush the dust off my hands, all at once aware of how foolish I have been. I guess I was wrong, I say. There's nothing here after all. Let's go. We have a long drive home. Margot places Rosalind James's diary back on its shelf and straightens the books around so that it looks as if we were never here. I give the room one last glance, then throw out my hands in surrender and make my way toward the stairs. I am already partway down when I hear Margot's voice coming from above me. Stop! I jog back up the steps and stand beside her at the entrance to the room. She's examining a portrait of the Reverend that is no more appealing than the bust. The canvas is largely covered in various shades of black, so that the white collar that supports Livingston James's double chin is in stark contrast to the background. The eyes I'm gazing into are porcine slits perched atop a pair of ruddy cheeks. I frown. This isn't any better. Margot shakes her head. I know, I'm going to have nightmares about those jowls. But look. She points at the film of dust that has settled on the frame. There is one place where it has been brushed away, as if someone had rested a finger on it. Slowly, I reach out and put my own thumb into the negative space the absence of dust has created. Using the thumb as an anchor, I can reach around beneath the frame with my other fingers and slip them up behind the painting. I pat blindly, not sure what I hope to find. And then I feel a rough edge of crinkled tape that gives way to something smoother, well-suited for wrapping birthday presents. Scotch was not even a company when this painting was framed. There is no reason for tape of that sort to be stuck to the back of it. I stretch my hand further, and then I feel it. A small, raised bump, nothing more. There's something back here, I tell Margot, only I can't quite reach it. Here, she says, and reaches around me to gently pull the corners of the frame ever so slightly forward. I slip my hands up in the space she's created, and now I can feel the edges of the object. It's square, an inch or so long at most, and flat enough that no one would have noticed it if they hadn't been looking. Carefully, I pry it up and work at the underside of the strip of tape to ease it off the painting's backing. Then, all at once, it comes free and I'm holding the red square in my hand. I turn the flash drive over and finally close my fist around it. What do you think is on there? Margot asks. I haven't the faintest idea. I resist the urge to plug the drive into my laptop right away. Something about the lengths Essie has gone to hide it makes me want to get out of town as quickly as we can. Margot insists on driving, and I don't protest. I'm trembling as I lower myself into the car, and it has nothing to do with the espresso. I'm certain now that I was right to worry about Essie all along. No one who is happy to be walking down the aisle hides a flash drive and then sets out a trail of breadcrumbs for the only reporter she knows is on her side. Once the car is parked and Margot has left to meet her wife, I take the stairs to my apartment two at a time. I'm already pulling the drive out of my pocket as I walk in, but I immediately stop short and shove it down again. Mike is blocking the entrance, arms folded, dark eyes narrowed.
I thought you said you would call her.
I slip off my shoes and stow my bag in the closet in order to avoid the confrontation. When I can delay no longer, I turn around and shut the closet door behind me. I will. I promise, I assure him.
When?
He asks. He is clearly not impressed. You know what she wants to talk about.
I do.
He agrees too quickly.
Quentin Ames is up for parole. Your mother told me. She left messages on your voicemail every day last week, which you ignored, and now she's calling here. I shouldn't have answered, but she called 5 times in a row, and eventually I broke down. I can't be in the middle of this. You know what will happen if I am.
I'm sorry.
You don't have to be sorry, but you do have to tell her. Because if you don't, then I will. She has a right to know.
You don't know what it would do to her. Mike shakes his head and finally backs up, letting me come farther into the room.
I do know, remember? Because I watched it happen to you.
I walk past him and throw myself down onto the couch. The truth is, Mike is right, and there is no way around it. I should have told her a long time ago. I would have, maybe, if we had still been speaking. It would have just come out. How could it not? In between telling her about the new steakhouse that opened down the street or why I hate my boss, it would have slipped out. How everything she thought she knew about how her daughter died simply wasn't true. At first, it was fun. It was like a sleepover. The younger kids especially were excited, giddy at the change. For Justice and me, though, things felt pretty close to normal, as strange as that might seem. We were in a different place, but we still did chores in the morning and the afternoon, and in between, we had school with Mama. Justice could read much better than I could. I remember that. Though she sometimes pretended not to know a word. She would ask me for help, and I would make her sound it out, even though I knew her confusion was just an act. Then she would flash a grateful smile and bury her head back in her book. There were plenty of books to choose from once Ames and Pa and some of the other men broke into the visitor center, though the subject matter was limited to the area's geography, and a few volumes of colored illustrations useful for identifying local birds. Before we moved into the visitor center, we prayed and cooked and slept under the stars. Black Rock was still open to tourists then, with twice daily guided tours through some of the deeper caves. Quentin Ames had printed off some flyers announcing the occupation, but really, I think no one in town took him seriously. 3 weeks had passed before anyone realized that we were there. Ames had chosen a small clearing near the perimeter of the park for our initial settlement. There was a cave nearby that he said was sacred, and from which he claimed the Messiah would rise again. At the time, I didn't question this. I took everything he said for truth. We came and went as needed through the Laramie's back pastures, which abutted Black Rock near a trail that led almost directly to the camp. It was still warm, but even then it was clear that Ames was preparing for the winter. He himself never left the park grounds, but he would send Pa and Mo Laramie and some of his other most trusted followers back into town to stock up on supplies. Canned goods went into the cave to the right of the one reserved for the Messiah, while guns were kept to the left. By the time a ranger spotted our encampment and called in the feds, we had enough spam to last for months. We moved to the visitor center in stages. The men went first, carrying rifles. By then, the tourists had been asked to leave, but additional law enforcement had yet to arrive. The few staff that remained were still inside the visitor center when Pa and Quentin stormed the small, shingled building. Pa took the time to pick the lock, even though Ames had urged him to skip that part and just break down the door. Pa would be punished for his disobedience publicly. But Mama whispered to me in justice that Pa did it because he knew we would need that door later. Would need it to keep out the cold. Ames didn't take hostages. He said he had no use for non-believers, and that they would only distract from what we had been called to Black Rock to do. To witness. We moved camp quickly while the naturalists, some of whom I recognized from town, scurried off in their matching brown shirts and name tags in the direction of the main road. In the meantime, Ames set up a perimeter that protected the trails back to the cave, claiming that acreage as our own. He barked out orders to the adults and then turned his gaze on us. Besides Justice and me, there were 8 other children, not counting the Nichols boys, who at 14 and 15 wanted everyone to believe that they were grown men. Though Ames was laughing and joking loudly with some of the other men when Mama hurried us past them and into the visitor center, she moved furtively and her voice sounded scared. We huddled together in the corner, the older children comforting the younger, when Mama left us so she could return to the caves to fetch more supplies. Mama was still gone when Quentin Ames took 5-year-old Virginia Murphy roughly by the hand and led the sobbing girl outside. We followed because we knew we had to, and I saw Ames tug Ginny once more by the arm and then let go. He picked up a stick and sliced its pointed end through the dusty ground. "There," he commanded, "play." I looked at the ground and saw that Ames had carved the rough outlines of a hopscotch court. Ginny remained frozen, clutching at her wrist where Ames had grabbed it. "Play," he said again, and his voice was dangerous. "We need a pebble," Justice demanded, apparently unafraid.
"There's no shortage of them here," Ames replied, throwing his arms out to either side. "Find one for yourselves."
Ames sauntered back toward the visitor center, kicking up dust with his boots. And Mo Laramie handed him a rifle. The two men leaned against the building in the shade of the porch and watched Justice. Mo spat out a wad of soggy tobacco into a patch of dry grass. My sister stood with her hand on one hip and surveyed her surroundings. She kept her back toward the men. Then she skipped forward and bent to collect a smooth black stone. She turned it over in her hand, running her fingers across the surface and finally brushing it against her jeans to rub it clean. Justice handed the rock to me.
"You go first," she offered.
I glanced over her shoulder to Quentin Ames.
"Don't mind them," she told me. "Go ahead."
I took the pebble from her and threw it. We had all gone 2 or 3 times at least when the first of the squad cars rolled up. It kept its distance, stopping a ways off where the driveway turned to dirt and the welcome sign was mounted on top of a small rise. Virginia Murphy stood frozen on one foot, It looked like she might start to cry again. We all watched the officer climb out, moving slowly and careful to remain protected by the vehicle. I didn't need to turn around to know that Ames and the other men weren't hiding their guns. The officer waited until three other cars screeched to a halt beside his, and then he pulled out a bullhorn.
Quentin!
The voice crackled.
What on God's green earth do you think you're doing?
The officer took off his hat and wiped a cloth over the top of his head. I recognized him as Derek Cumberland, who was a few years younger than my father but older than Quentin Ames. Derek had been the captain of the high school track team the year Uncle Court, Mama's brother, had been a senior, and they got all the way to the state championship. Of course, they lost to Nixville, but you would never know it the way Court tells the tale. So, Derek Cumberland and the men on the porch may not have been friends, but they weren't strangers. There were no strangers in our town, except for the tourists who were only passing through. People kept to themselves. Their children might not go to school, but even so, each one of us was essentially a known quantity. Not Quentin, though. Unlike Pa and Court and Derek, who had all come up through school together, Quentin Ames was an outsider. He didn't move to town until he was 19. His parents had died or else he'd left them. I'd heard it told both ways. Even after the siege had ended and they were writing books about him, the facts were fuzzy. But the man himself never seemed that way when you were standing face to face with him. He looked crisp and sharp, despite his rumpled shirt and unwashed jeans. He demanded attention. He drew the eye. The eye of Derek Cumberland, for instance, never left Quentin Ames as he stepped out of the shade and protection of the porch. There were half a dozen others flanking the entrance to the visitor center, but the officers kept their guns trained on Quentin Ames. He walked forward, his rifle held casually at his side, and stopped in the middle of our forgotten game. He slung the rifle over his shoulder and lifted an arm to place a hand on my head.
Beautiful day to be enjoying the land, don't you think?
Ames spoke clearly but softly. Still, it was obvious that Officer Cumberland and the others had heard him well enough.
This is federal property,
Derek shouted, his bullhorn forgotten at his side.
This land belongs to the Lord,
Quentin Ames countered. Derek turned his head slightly to listen to what another one of the officers was saying, then called out,
The United States government would respectfully disagree. You all are going to have to clear out.
Ames stooped over and retrieved our black stone. He handed it to Justice and motioned for the rest of us to back up off the hopscotch court. Justice took the rock and held it in her outstretched hand. She glanced over at Pa. He must have nodded in response to whatever question was in that look, because she took a step back and tossed the pebble onto a square. Ames chuckled softly as Justice hopped and then spun around, the stone once again in her hand.
We're not going anywhere, he said to both no one and everyone, all at the same time.
I tend to think of this as one of my last memories of Justice. But the truth is, by the time she died, we had been at Black Rock for more than 120 days. Thanksgiving had come and gone, and though Quentin Ames led the group in a prayer about all that we had to be thankful for, I was angry to be eating spam and boiled potatoes instead of turkey smothered in Mama's cranberry sauce, and the sweet potatoes with little marshmallows melted on top. I was more than a little frightened of the cold, which had rolled in with the end of summer and seemed to blow straight through the walls. The snow helped some, when it fell in drifts taller than Justice and me. At least it blocked the wind. When Ames called out to me, Mama was knitting stockings. I could hear her needles. And although Christmas was just around the corner, the stockings were not for holding presents. They were for our feet. Mo Laramie had nearly lost a toe when a storm started up while he was out hunting. It took him hours to drag himself back through the squall with only a few squirrels to show for all his trouble. Mama made the fire as big as she dared, then heated some water to soak the foot in, while Mo cursed and spat and yelled at Luann to be more careful as she pulled off first his boot and then his frozen sock. I play these memories over in my head every so often, because as much as I hate them, I don't want to forget. I try to remember if I was even frightened or if that was just something I added in later when the shrinks and the social workers handed me crayons and encouraged me to draw pictures that would tell them each of the many ways I was broken deep inside. Knowing that fear was what they expected, I told them how Justice and I had clung together, four arms and four legs all tangled together in our sleeping bag, and cried ourselves to sleep at night. But we didn't. We giggled, we sang songs, we played with our flashlights for ages after we had been told to turn them off. For a long time after the day Quentin drew the hopscotch court, it all seemed like one big game. Even that last morning, the one when Justice followed orders and I didn't, I wasn't hiding beneath my covers because I was afraid of what might happen if I went to Ames when I was called. I wasn't saved by some sixth sense, some silent warning, some instinct of the forces that had been building up outside. It was because I was cold. It was because I was lazy that I got left behind. I would have gotten up if he had told me to just one more time. But he didn't. For whatever reason, he was satisfied to go with only Justice, and they went outside, the two of them, into the deep drifts of snow. It was my laziness that killed my sister. If there had been two of us, the shooter would have never fired. Pa told me so, even before we knew for sure that she was dead. Years later, I went back and saw the black marks on the cement floor where we cooked those squirrels and fried countless cans of Spam and even saved Mo Laramie's pinky toe. A school group stomped into the Black Rock Visitor Center, but the children didn't skirt the scorch marks as I had done. They walked right across them. Two little girls were holding hands and laughing. It made me want to hit them, to scream that this building did not deserve their laughter. I was offended that they weren't saddened by what had taken place there, though they had no reason to be. There wasn't even a plaque, since that would only encourage other militants. What happened there was just a footnote, a boring history lesson and nothing more. It was personal, only to me. Except that I know this isn't true. It was personal to Mama, too. It was why she wrote letter after letter to the parole board and regularly called the Department of Justice to demand that Ames's case be reviewed. It was why she was calling me now, though we haven't spoken for years, to ask me to write my own letter. Setting Quentin free had become an obsession for Mama. What she really wanted was to have her daughter back. But since that wasn't possible, she would settle for Quentin Ames instead.
Esther. That night I dream of Livingston James, and though I have only flashes of feeling to remember the nightmare by, I know it was about Libby as well. I should have just slipped her a note, or found a way to sneak a text from Rourke's phone before she and Margot drove out of town. But in truth, I've always felt that there are not many people in this town I can truly trust. Without many of them around, someone might have seen. They are kind to me. They go out of their way to be solicitous. But even without meaning to, they have